Hi, and welcome to Stories of Climate Change Hope, the podcast that brings you a little bit of hope every other week. My name is Steffen Schwartmann, and today we listen to the climate story of Theresa Landwehr and Kunwo Rohe. They are both students in the master's program Global Change Ecology at the University of Bayreuth in Germany. And today it's all about the forest, because Theresa and Kun developed a project that aims at planting trees locally as fast as possible. Hi Theresa, hi Kun, how are you doing?
Hey Steffen, nice to meet you. I'm fine.
Yeah, hey Steffen, I'm doing all right.
And we are connected over continents, I think. Theresa, where are you?
I'm in Germany at the moment, in my old hometown, at my parents' place in Lower Saxony.
And what about you, Kun?
I'm now in South Korea, a city named Sejong. This city is actually a, let's say, second capital of South Korea, which was newly developed to serve as a administrative center for South Korea. And now I'm here because my partner is working at an institute that is based in this city. And it's at the very center of South Korea.
Oh, so it's very far from Seoul.
Well, if you take KTX, which is an equivalent version of ITE of Germany, it only takes, let's say, 1 hour. Because South Korea is quite a small country.
Yeah, maybe one detail I need to add. I didn't mention this, but I also joined the Klimawald project a little bit later. So maybe I can also join, but it's a focus on you. I want to know more about you and tell the listener what the project is all about. So the first question, very basic. What is Klimawald?
No, it's your turn.
Kun, do you want to answer? I mean, you had the initial idea, so...
Klimawald means climate forest in English, which basically explains everything. So we wanted to build a patch of forest which can adapt to a changing climate. That's a brief description, I would say.
Yeah, so perhaps to add on that, I don't know, do we want to talk about the development of the project as well? Because I think at the beginning, actually, the focus was more on climate mitigation. And somehow during the entire process, it developed, or the focus was more on climate adaptation.
How did this change?
But I think it's... Kun, do you want to say something about that?
Well, basically, because forests, talking about climate change, it's not only like mitigation or adaptation when we do something on forest, because trees serve as, forests serve as carbon sink, and in that regard, it related to the climate mitigation. But at the same time, because they are organisms and they are affected by the temperature and precipitation, for example, so we have to look at the adaptation part in this climate change discussion when we do something on forest, because not every species can adapt to the changing climate, as you might already know from the state of the German forest, where spruce and pines are wilting and dying and turning into brown, dead wood rapidly recently.
So how did you decide, or like, what tree species did you plant then? I mean, is it possible to know what tree species will be more adapted to the climate in the future?
So maybe my explanation needs more elaboration. So basically, at first, we had this naive idea to plant some trees because our carbon footprint is so huge. But as we developed our project, we realized that even a hectare of forest can reduce only so much from our carbon footprint. So it doesn't really make sense to only focus on climate mitigation. So we then started to think about the adaptation part, and from your question, I mean, related to your question, luckily we had this forest expertise at the University of Bayreuth, whose name is Dr. Gregor Wass. And because he's he's an expert in forestry and forest ecology. So he already knew, and he was researching those species which can potentially adapt to the changing climate, which he's not 100% sure, but he had more clues than the others. So I went to his office and I was asking a bunch of questions, and gladly he agreed on my suggestion, which was, how about to have a portfolio of various species rather than having only a few species, which is actually what people usually do when they plant trees. They usually pick just a few species to make it simple.
I still remember the day when we went to Gregor's office, you too, Kuhn.
Mm-hmm.
It was super relaxed. We basically went there and knocked at his door and talked about our idea. And then we talked about the species selection. And I still remember how positive and optimistic he was. And he just said, like, yes, that's a nice idea. And yeah, we should talk about the species selection. There are several options. And yeah, let's have a meeting and go to the forest site and see about the local conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really nice that he gave such a positive feedback directly at the beginning of the project, because I think it motivated us and we just started directly. So we didn't think about the entire project set up super long, but we just started somehow. So yeah, I still remember the meeting. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it was really nice, I think.
Yeah, I think I never heard that story. About the first meeting. But now how you describe it, I can imagine it. And I know that, yeah, Gregor Aas is a super nice guy. And I can imagine how even mm-hmm. more motivated you were after the meeting, you know. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm also interested, when I invite people to the podcast, sometimes I also ask with relation to their study program, you know, because some listeners, maybe they are still thinking of what to study or what to do as a master degree. And then I also want to ask you, like, what would you say, like, did your study program somehow prepare you to develop this project? Or did it help you?
I can start, perhaps, if that's fine for you, Kuhn.
Yes, please.
So my spontaneous answer on this question would be yes. The study program Global Change Ecology really helped me setting up the project, because it provides a lot of flexibility in the entire study program. And of course, we also have super motivated and supportive students and also study program coordinators who, yeah, really try to help and support us as much as possible. So I think, yes, the study program really helped us also due to, or with regards to, yeah, working together and in a team aiming for a common goal. And also, yeah, the interdisciplinarity, which is also a huge part, or yeah, part of our study program, because it's an international and interdisciplinary study program. And I think this aspect also helped during the entire project process when we talked with our stakeholders, for example, because we have stakeholders from forestry, from science, from the public, of course. So I think that was also something that was helpful.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, I just wanted to add, and maybe I can be more specific. I think it was so lucky that there was this course called project management when I was thinking about this project. So at the very beginning, I had this idea just for myself. I was going to do it anyway. And then I found out this course, which was under the schedule of GCE program. And then I was like, okay, because I don't have any experience developing a project, this course might help. And I just sent an email to Dr. Birgit Thies, telling that I have this idea to plant some trees with my fellow students, and it would be really nice to be able to learn something from you, because she, as a director of this interdisciplinary research platform at the University of Bayreuth by CEO, she already had many experiences with different projects. And yeah, it turns out that it was really helpful, and I was able to meet not only Teresa, but actually before Teresa, I met Nikunj Pathak from India. And yeah, with this unexpected, let's say, interactions and the interest from Nikunj and Teresa, this project came into reality. So I think not only the GC program, but the fact that there were so many students from different parts of the world who were studying under the umbrella of BICEA really helped us to develop this project.
Yeah, it's really great that you found so much support even in the beginning. And I think it's not, yeah, like, I wouldn't even say that you were just lucky. I think, you know, you really convinced people to join the project. And I guess it's also about you, like how you tell people about the project, that they think, oh yeah, these two or these three, I think they could really pull it off. We could do it together.
Not sure if they've thought in that way at the very beginning. Yeah.
Well, it worked out, you know, and yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. In this initial stage, when you two thought about the project, or you developed the project, did you immediately see, maybe it's difficult to say, but did you see that maybe there were some skills that you needed to improve, or were you all set up and you thought like, okay, I know what to do. I know how to do it. Let's do it.
Actually, I think it was a lot of learning by doing, because the entire project developed at the same time as the course project management was happening. So it was not the case that we had this course project management and then we developed our project, but it happened at the same time. So it was really a lot of learning by doing. I don't know, perhaps Kun, you want to add something, but what Kun told me and Nikunj told me, because setting up a project in Germany sometimes requires the German language. So I think there was one skill that we needed, and that was my main part in the project team, I think, because from the student core team, let's say, so at the beginning it was Kun, Nikunj and me, I was the only German speaking person. So perhaps that was my skill.
Yeah, truly. And I don't know what to add. Yeah. So German language, that was our weakest part. And I was so glad to have Teresa. And I vividly remember when Birgit asked around to the students who were in the project management course, if there was anyone who is interested in joining in our project. And Teresa was, I think, hesitating just for a few seconds and raised her hand faster than the other Teresa, as far as I remember. And I think that was such a crucial moment for our project.
Yeah, I think it's really...
Yeah, but other than that, it's so true. We were learning by doing it.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps if you ask others about our skills, like, for example, Birgit Thies from the Bicier, I think she would say, yes, we have skills. But yeah, Kun and me, we are a bit hesitant. But yeah, as we said, it was a lot of learning by doing, but I think not everyone would have been able to really set up the project. It was really a very good combination, I think, out of different personalities. And I think we were super motivated and that really helped us. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you had the project idea. Yeah, learning by doing. That's really also great to, I think, tell others, because if you think about developing your own project, it's always like, oh, I have such a great idea, but where to even start? And when you say it's learning by doing, you know, just start. I think that can be very motivating, like just reach out to someone like a friend and then someone who could support you in the project and then basically start and you will figure it out. It's a very, very strong and helpful statement, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if you would have asked me or Kun 2 years ago, I think we would not have believed that we are able to set up a project in this scale, or that we are able to realize it also in such a quick time or period of time. And it got bigger and bigger. And yeah, I think it's really nice to experience that everyone could actually just start setting up a project. As long as you are motivated and you find supportive and cooperating people around you, you could just start. So you don't need to have, I don't know, plenty of skills, but you can always learn by doing. And yeah, I think that was one of my biggest learnings from the entire project. So not just learning, and then start somewhere, but just start.
Yeah, this is so great. and developing this, having developed this project and having seen how successful it was, did this also influence you, for example, in expectations you have or things like believing in yourself, having maybe different goals than before, or thinking, oh my God, I did this project, like now I can do much more? Was there something like this for you?
Maybe I can start. I was not actually thinking too much on myself after we got some attention from university and media and the fellow students who were being really nice and giving us good comments and feedbacks. I was actually looking at the shortcomings,
mm-hmm. Is that yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The limitations that we found from our project. And I was at the same time thinking about the climate action that we are so desperate to make. And even though I was looking at these limitations, one thing I realized is that the politicians and the government should start, and they will see the limitation. Same as I did, but from that point they can improve. So that was my learning. I wasn't really satisfied, and I'm not satisfied, because I'm now these days trying to convey this idea to Korea and people are not listening and people don't see this as a problem on top of this whole corona situation. But anyway, when we talk about climate actions, like, I think we cannot ask for a perfect plan. And that was the case for us. We didn't have a perfect plan, but we just started at the very, very, from the scratch. And then you can build up from there. I don't know if my explanation was clear.
Yeah, I think it was clear. And I can understand, like, because of climate change, like just about, for example, the selection of tree species, there are still assumptions or some experiments maybe in the lab that, okay, maybe this tree species would be the best. But with regards to climate change, also some uncertainties. So yeah, I can understand. And also now that you have struggles setting up something similar in Korea. Mm. And how was it for you, Teresa? Was it similar that you, after or in between, like you are still very involved, that you, like, did it change somehow you as a person and what you think you can achieve?
That's a difficult question. To be honest, I think I just realized I should take some time to reflect on that question. but my spontaneous answer on this would be, yeah, I think perhaps somehow it changed my personality a bit. Because usually I'm more like a shy person, standing more in the background. And with the project, I was forced to, somehow stand in the forefront and talk to people. And so perhaps, yes, that somehow influenced me in, like, realizing I can do that, but I still don't like it. But at least I know that I can do it, that I'm able to do that. And like, from a professional point of view, let's say, like with regards to future career or profession, I still like the academic work a lot, But perhaps I also realized that I really like project work, like working with different people, really doing something practical. And perhaps I will do both in the future, or perhaps it changes, like there will be a time when I do this more and then I will do more the practical stuff. But yeah, it's also possible to do both. Like you can, in your free time, you can do the practical work and setting up projects in your local hometown, and you can still do academic research or stuff like that. It just made me realize that I really enjoy the practical work and like seeing results. That's really nice. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really cool that, yeah.
Yeah, I was just curious how Kuhn thinks about it. It's a really difficult question. I don't know if it changes the personality, probably, but it's hard to say it.
I mean,
perhaps it's more easy for others to observe it observing your own.
I was actually just enjoying listening to Teresa's reflection. And honestly, because I have a quite a low expectation, or let's say low self-estimation for me, for myself, I can hardly remember a moment when I was delightful. Like, I think there were like few moments that I can recall, like I was happy, but like after just few let's say minutes and few hours, I was like again concerning about like next steps and like what can I improve, what can we improve, and what didn't work, and yeah, all those things. So I don't know, I mean, it was really nice to be able to, you know, make this forest, even though it's such a small area compared to the forests that are burning for me, because it was such a unique experience as a foreigner to be able to communicate, let's say, even though I wasn't really communicating by myself, but I was able to convey my idea, and it seemed that even though I wasn't using the same language, they understood me, thanks to Teresa, of course. So I think like those moments are my rewards, not like after we got some awards or that like some media coverage came out, not those moments. I think like the very moments when we were talking with our stakeholders, for example, the Stadtforestry, Mr. Dick Muschig and Mr. Udo Wenzel from ELF Bayreuth. Yeah, people like these, when we were meeting them, it was just so nice to be able to share our visions and find the common ground and build up the project together.
Yeah, I totally agree with what Kuhn just said. And I think one more moment or moments when we realized what has happened was also when talking to our fellow students or friends, like when they just contacted us and told us, hey, it's just great what you did. Also you, Stefan, when we met with you, because as Kuhn said, Kuhn and me, we are both quite self-critical. And then when people just told us, hey, you did such great things, then somehow we realize it. but I think the best reward was just to see how the project got bigger and bigger, and more people contacted us. And there are just like doors that kind of opened there were more and more opportunities, and people offered like so many different things, and everyone wanted to get involved somehow, and that was just nice. I think that was one of the best rewards we could ever get.
Yeah, so you mentioned how much, or yeah, like in general, like you really couldn't really like to the meetings with the partners and helping each other. And Teresa, you really liked when others showed interest and wanted to join the project. And I'm interested in, are there maybe specific moments where you thought, wow, like where you really would from today would say, this was a personal highlight for me. Was there a meeting or a moment when you were in the forest that you would say, wow, this is so good. I'm really happy that I'm doing this. Would you like to start, Kun, if you can answer?
Well, I mean, I don't think I can rank those moments, but to be fair to the participants, I think we were so delighted when people actually showed up in the morning at the very first day for the first planting event. Because even though a lot of people, they reserved their seats, I don't know, places, whatever.
They registered on the website?
Yeah, they registered. They registered that they want to plant some trees. Because we had these shifts. We had in total 9 shifts for 3 days. And yeah, there were so many people who were interested in. But still, we were so worried that people simply wouldn't show up. And then at the first day, they actually showed up, and that was, we were so thankful because people showed up. And from that point, I think, yeah, okay, we were convinced that we can make it happen. And yeah, as time goes, because usually the morning shift were less people than the afternoon shift, the more people showed up, and yeah, we got energy from them, and they were so motivated and asking questions. And, you know, it was before Corona, so we were able to talk, and people could eat, drink, and everything. It was really nice, yeah.
I just wanted to stress here, because to make everyone understand who's listening, because Kun said, oh, it's just such a small area. Well, it's one hectare, the area that was planted, but it's not an industrial operation. So it's just, yeah, like students developing this idea. And then if you imagine you would be on your own, just like 5 people planting, it would take weeks to plant them. So I think it's really, amazing that so many people turned up. But yeah, how was it for you, Teresa? Is there a specific moment?
So yes, I definitely remember the moment that Kun just mentioned. It's very nice memory. Perhaps another memory that I really remember is when we had a meeting with our stakeholders in the forest site, the first planting site. And I still remember, I think, Kun, it was when you had your farewell just 1 month ago. And Mr. Gregor Aas, and he's from the Botanical Garden, and Dirk Muschig from the City Forestry Bayreuth, they just mentioned during our chat that they had an excursion with foresters from Franconia some weeks ago. And that was something where we as students were not involved, but just since they got to know each other during the project, they just had a new kind of cooperation and just invited people and do those excursions just on their own. and try to transfer the knowledge and help other foresters to set up those hopefully climate resilient forest sites. And I still remember that moment because I was like, wow, that's so great. Like, perhaps or probably both of them, they didn't talk to each other before the entire project. So perhaps they didn't even know each other. And after our project and the initiation, they just like start excursions and information events on their own. And that was really nice to see, and that they are so motivated and they just do it in their free time and try to convince others. That was really nice.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing these insights. I think it's really valuable and helpful to others. Because, like when you're developing a project or when you are doing something unpaid, I think it's so good really to reflect about what you do and cherish those moments. Because in between, you are doing so many different things. You are studying. You maybe have a part-time job and you have this project, and then it can be a struggle. And then if you have these moments, I think it really makes it so worthwhile. Like, besides the whole goal of making forests more climate resilient, but also personally, I think this makes it really special. And
Yeah, thanks, Stefan, for giving us the opportunity to reflect on those.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm just glad that you are here and you you agreed to be on the podcast. So I need to thank you.
I would have a question to Kun actually, because Kun, you mentioned that you are trying to establish a similar project in South Korea at the moment, or at least to somehow replace the current dominant tree species. Could you talk about that a bit more? I'm interested in that.
I'm talking to people about Klimabird. I mean, the model that we made. And I am actually observing the reactions, because the whole climate issue is not as important as how Germans are discussing. I mean, I know you might not be so satisfied with your situation, but compared to us, I think it's much better there. So because we, let's say, do have a similar issue that in certain places, the forests are not so diverse. And even to talk about this diversity issue is not so easy, because people simply don't agree with me. So I'm trying to find a way to be more, convincing. Because I think it's a problem that people will not agree with some climate issues until they really see the damage. So I think in Germany, because you're seeing such a massive area of dying forest, like, there's no one who would really argue about it. I mean, the problem of having this 50% of the whole forest being composed of only two species. You're seeing it, so no one will argue about it. But in Korea, we are not at that point. I think we have, let's say, a better composition, a bit better, because we don't have a commercially valuable forest yet. And because of that, we didn't really manage that heavily. We haven't changed the forest with the most valuable tree species, unlike Germany. So I'm now trying to build up these stories, and trying to convey the importance of having diverse set of tree species, not only composed of native tree species, but also non-natives from southern parts, because we are in a northern hemisphere and the temperatures are rising, and the potential distribution of species are going northward. So it's not that I have a site and I have these people like you and Greg Was, Dick Music, and Udo Wenze. It's just me and our designer, Adam, who are trying to share our experience that we had in Bayreuth. And so far, the reactions are not so exciting.
Do you think there's still a chance, like maybe if you find the right partners to get something going, because it would be really, kind of devastating if you need to have the visual impact of climate change on the forests with the more frequent drought events, then people just react like you say it's better here, but I guess it's just like the government and civil society and people are reacting because they can see it, but I guess this is too late, right?
So we have a saying in Korea that idiots repair their farmhouse after typhoon, let's say. I'm translating it, not directly. So
okay.
I think we will only repair something or do something proactively once we see some kind of damage. I think that's in our nature. So I don't know really. Like nowadays, for the last few months and years, I think it feels like only it's been a year when this climate strike and Fridays for Future and everything started. Is it like more than 1 year? But anyway, so the younger generations are asking for more actions, but like these old people are, feels like they are waiting for more visual clues. And you're so right. It's gonna be too late once we see those clues.
Yeah, this is one of the biggest challenges of climate change, I think. Like, usually people need to see it, to act, to realize about the risk, and then they start acting. But as you said, Stefan, it's too late for climate change, or with regards to climate change, because once we see it, we reach the tipping points. So this logic doesn't work for climate change. Start acting when you see things. It doesn't work because then it's too late, and then we already have passed some tipping points, and then it's irreversible. So that's a really huge problematic.
Yes.
So therefore, start acting now. As we said, you can just start. You learn so much, and you know much more than you are even aware of. And everyone can just start something, even if it's just a little thing. It might turn into something bigger. And then it can really help, maintaining a future living for.
It is also not too bad if you have a really great idea and you try your best and it does not work. Like, there's this word, and sometimes there are these events called happy fail, where you are also acknowledging that not everything is going perfect. Like, also PhD students and researchers sharing how many times they failed, or people who apply for funding for their project, it does not always work. And and it's okay. Like, you still learn a lot, and you will improve. But I think it's important to yeah, stay consistent. Yeah. If you know what, like, so even like you said, Teresa, even something small, if you know that this will improve the future, this will improve the situation for everyone, then yeah, stay at it and stay consistent and trying to make it work.
Yeah. Because this argumentation of, I cannot do anything, and I'm just one single person, first the others should start doing something, that doesn't work, because if everyone just transfers the responsibility to others, then in the end no one starts. And yeah, it's too late to wait any longer. Everyone just has to start. Even like if it's on the local scale or individual scale or national or international level, I think we really have to address all levels and act on all levels.
Yes. And just a short question to Kun, what you said before, because when you mentioned this saying, I thought there was something coming, like you said, like, idiots repair their house or their farm after a typhoon. And then I thought, okay, I'm more proactive or something like that. Like, was that the whole saying or is there something to it?
It was the whole saying. I mean, yeah. So your friends will tell you about it when you're trying to study one day before your exam. So like, yeah, that you're not being proactive and you're not being so prepared. Yeah.
Okay.
Perhaps I have a quote that I would like to add as well. It just came to my mind. So I think he was the first Czech president. I think his name is Mr. Havel or so. But like the main thing is, he said that hope does not mean optimism. So it's not the, it's not being convinced that something turns out good in the end, but it's rather the certainty that something makes sense, no matter how it ends, like if it will be positive in the end. But as long as you know that something makes sense, just start and yeah, stay hopeful. Yeah.
Yeah, it's such a nice quote. Thank you for sharing, Teresa. Yeah, like sometimes when I tell people about their podcast, then I feel like I need to justify, because is it still okay to be hopeful, or is this already too positive? But then I say, like, it does not mean I think everything will be great and I can just stop worrying. It just means that I want to stay hopeful and do something to, yeah, like for my time now, for our time now, we can still do as much as we can do today. We cannot change the past, and maybe we will not change the world, but we can contribute to it. And this also relates to one of the last questions for today. Yeah, maybe you want to start, Kun. My question is, where do you find hope?
I mean,
or what gives you hope?
Before you ask me to be on this podcast, I was so worried because I'm really not an optimistic person. And this is such a hard question. I don't want to lie. These days, it's really hard to find hope. Yeah, it's really hard to find hope. So, for example, 3 days ago on Saturday, I had this small online meeting to talk about car-free cities in Korea. It's not that we have car-free cities, but we were discussing if we can potentially implement some ideas from that concept, the car-free cities. Basically, reduce cars, more public transportation, more room for work, pedestrians and, you know, bikers and things like that. And we had 60 people, which was nice because 60 people showed up. But so let's say hope part is that number 60. But when there's a hope, I mean, at least for me, there's always this, I don't know, bitterness or depressing realization of being so small. Like I told you that the forest was too small compared to the area of forest that burnt this year, let's say. So 60 people was large enough to be really, you know, motivated and discuss about the car-free cities and, you know, learn something new. But at the same time, we know, because in Korea, there are 50 million people, who we maybe half of them should be convinced let's say even 10%. It's such a lot of people that we are living together, and it's, for me, it's always a very small fraction of powerless people who show up. So yeah, there's a hope. Even the powerless people don't give up. That's amazing. But I think this hope, it's not only hope, it always goes to this bitterness that I taste. So sorry, this is not a good answer. Like, I cannot really talk about hope.
No, that's like a perfect answer. Like, of course, the podcast is called Stories of Climate Change Hope, but you can also say if you're not hopeful, I mean, and you said you're kind of in between, like you found it really good that 60 people showed up for your event on car-free cities, but you are not sure about what it will change, because maybe their role in society, they are not in a powerful position. Yeah, a couple of months ago, I read a book about which took account and described some of the successes of social movements in the last century and also in the last few years. And then, you know, like some of these movements started really small with only a few people. And if you look back to what they have achieved, like they have completely changed some of the societies. And that, after that, like reading that book and also some other things at that time, but it really made clear to me that, you know, these things, they can really lead to a change. It is maybe not the change that comes from the government directly, but the government and the law is maybe reacting, actually. So not proactive, but reacting to these movements and to these developments inside the society. So that's why what you described, I think it's, for me, it is really helpful. I mean, yeah, 60 people showed up for probably an online event. Yeah. What about you, Teresa? Is it similar for you, or can you find hope?
Yeah, to be honest, it's a really difficult question and I really had to think about it, but I agree with both of you. So sometimes there, or most of the time, I'm also, I personally feel, yeah, very like little and weak, and like seeing all the problems ongoing at the moment. But yeah, as you said, Steffen, I think there are also those kind of tipping points in social conventions. So I think it's like 2 years ago or so, there was an article in Science investigating the empirical evidence for those tipping points in society. And I think they said it's like 20 or 25% of the population that needs to be convinced, and then something will happen. And yeah, as you said, I think in the past we've seen that if problems are taken serious, like also with regards to Corona, or also like, for example, the example of the ozone layer, like if people are really convinced that it's a problem, and then something can happen so quickly and people just start acting, and then yeah, it might prevent the catastrophe. So I think that gives me hope that it doesn't, not everyone needs to be convinced, but it's like the movement is growing, and perhaps sometimes, or one day, hopefully soon, we will reach the critical point so that something happens, and yeah, that we can make a lot of pressure on the politicians and decision makers to act. And what helps me as well is surrounding myself with people who are doing something and who are really trying every day and fight so hard that something is happening. And that really helps me, like, just see that there are many people fighting for a better world, and that really helps me still perhaps still believing in hope. But
thank you. If we have time, maybe a few more minutes, then I would come to the last question, which is more, it can be about anything. The question is, what are you looking forward doing in the next days or next 2 weeks? Can be personal, can be study related. Like now, today is the 22nd of December, so in a few days it's Christmas. Maybe you're sorry. Just go ahead. Would you start, Kun?
I actually got a piece of stolen from Adam's coworker, so I think I'll enjoy that.
Sorry, what did you get? A piece of
the bread, the German bread.
Ah, okay, stolen. Okay, yeah. Stolen, yeah.
Yeah. So they are selling it even in Korea, and then they usually sell it during this time, the Christmas time. So yeah, I'm looking forward to having it, maybe with some glue wine, because I was able to bring one bottle of glue wine back to Korea. So yeah, that'd be lovely.
Please share a photo with us, and then, you and Adam. I would love to see that.
Sure, I'll do so. And actually, I just remembered. So on the 24th, the Christmas Eve, there's this small environmental group who is going to screen a documentary called "This Will Change Everything." So it's originally a book written by Naomi Klein, and yeah, they were very nice to make it freely available for 100 people who register. So I was able to register, so I think I can watch that with Ara with a nice cup of glue wine and the stolen.
That's nice.
That's what I'm looking forward to. This. Yeah.
What about you, Teresa?
Mm, Yeah, I'm looking forward to spend some time with my family and friends back home, because I don't see them so often, also this year, especially due to Corona. So yeah, I'm looking forward to spend some time with my family and friends. And also perhaps thanks to the podcast today, I'm looking forward to reflect on what has happened this year and take some time to calm down and just reflect what has happened, and also to make perhaps some plans for the new year and for my future in general. Yeah, I'm looking forward just for some calm and relaxed days. Yeah.
How about you, Stefan?
Oh,
I'm also curious about your plan.
It's the first time someone asked me this, actually.
It was the same for me. I think for Kuhn as well.
It's not so easy.
Your turn.
Next week, well, of course, I hope I will get into the Christmas spirit, being more relaxed, like the next 2-3 days. So I'm not going home. We will have like a virtual Christmas. So just like the video call. And I really hope that it will somehow be at least have the same atmosphere, although we can't be in the same room, not in the same place. Yeah. And then another thing is that you already mentioned Nikunj Pathak. Next week, I will have a conversation with him and another friend, Ori Lyonga, for the podcast. And this will be about, like how writing can help us reflect and can help us to, maybe develop projects and also write stories that can be shared with others too. Yeah, not just share some facts like about the Klimawald project or climate action, but also share our stories and share some fiction that might also be really interesting for people to just listen to or read.
Oh, that's so cool.
Cool.
Yeah, so thank you so much, Teresa and Kuhn. Thank you so much for agreeing to be here today and sharing your insights into the project and also sharing your reflections on it and how it even helped you develop. And so thanks.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thanks to you. Yeah, it was nice to talk to you.
Before we really finally end with this episode, I would like to read out the poem that Teresa mentioned. The poem by Václav Havel is called Hope. Either we have hope within us or we do not. It is a dimension of the soul and is not essentially dependent on some particular observation of the world. Hope is an orientation of the spirit, an orientation of the heart. It transcends the world that is immediately experienced and is anchored somewhere beyond its horizons. Hope, in this deep and powerful sense, is not the same as joy that things are going well, or willingness to invest in enterprises that are obviously headed for early success, but rather an ability to work for something because it is good, not because it stands a chance to succeed. Hope is definitely not the same thing as optimism. It is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but certainty that something makes sense regardless of how it turns out. It is hope, above all, which gives the strength to live and continually try new things. Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks goes to Coco for the creative support and the logo design. And also thanks to Vulcan Recorder for the music contribution. You can listen to the podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and all other podcast distribution apps on your phone. The next episode will be released in 1 week or 2 weeks. Thank you for listening and make sure to tune in next time. Bye bye.